Okay, we're apparently recording now. Thank you, Robin. Next Sunday, we will have a special worship service to help develop action items and programs in response to the Black Lives Matter movement. I have asked, I think, 8 of you to be listeners to our group discussion next Sunday. And if those listeners could come up front for a brief meeting after coffee hour today, that would be great. You know, go ahead and schmooze and have some coffee and then come forward. We'll talk a little bit about what we want to do next Sunday. I thought I would begin today by giving a little summary of the consequences of our hanging a Black Lives Matter banner on the side of the church following the dedication ceremony back in the spring. As you recall, it was originally right over the area where we come in Sunday morning. It was a few months later that our church secretary received a call from a woman who had rented this space for a piano recital some months earlier, before we put up the Black Lives Matter banner. And she said she was upset about the banner because her piano people and parents and stuff would be seeing it and so forth. So I called her back, and she said she was upset. And I said, I'm comfortable with you being upset a little bit. And then I was just let her talk a little bit. And at one point she said something like, well, I just don't see why a church would have a banner like that. So I said, I can tell you why if you care to listen. So I did, and she did, and it was, if it wasn't cordial, it was at least civil. And I said, well, I'll take your concern back to the board. And she said, I would rather take my concern personally to the board. So perhaps she did not think that I would be an honest reporter of her concern. Fine. So I did, and I think she talked. Did she talk to you, Linda? She talked to Linda, she talked to Jill, and she talked to Stan. How did she miss Steve? She talked to all the officers but Steve. You got out of there. But anyhow, as it was reported back, she was rather less civil to the members of the congregation than she was to the minister. Now, I'm used to that. People are more civil to ministers than they are to normal human beings. I get that. And I'm sorry that our members had to have a less civil conversation, but I wasn't surprised about it. We discussed it at some length at the next board meeting, very, very seriously, and I was really impressed with how seriously the board took our commitment to the banner and the concern of the woman who had rented our space. And if I can sum it correctly, and please feel free to talk to Linda, Jill, or Stan about their viewpoint on this later, is we thought the best argument that she had was one that she actually didn't make. And that was that she rented the space months before the Black Lives Matter banner was up. She did not have the opportunity to see the banner and say, well, maybe I'll go someplace else. So I thought that was, just from a, dare I say, a commercial aspect or a community aspect, it was fair to take that concern. We also reflected on that the banner being at that point where it was just, that's where we put it up. There were several places that we could put it, and finally we just said, well, let's put it there because we want to put it someplace, and it's better to get it up and put it up than it is to endlessly parse the best place for it to go. So when it was suggested that we put it up where it is now, you know, sort of on the second story of the parish hall, I felt like it was a compromise but not a surrender, you know, because maybe that was a better place for it in the first place, you know, that in as much as, well, it's actually harder to tear down if it's up there and it hasn't been defaced, then I think that speaks well for Staten Island in our neighborhood. And also, as much as we support Black Lives Matter, maybe it's not the center of everything we do. Maybe it's part of what we do. So anyhow, that's where we are about it, with the banner. But I got to say that in terms of social justice and equality, including Black Lives Matter, for some time now, I've felt a little bit like Billy Pilgrim. Remember who Billy Pilgrim is? He's the main character in Slaughterhouse-Five. He was the guy who, he's a surrogate for the author, Kurt Vonnegut, who was captured and spent time in a German prison camp in Dresden. And while he was an American soldier imprisoned in Dresden, he experienced the bombing of Dresden. And in the novel, as Billy Pilgrim, he says, Billy Pilgrim is unstuck in time. And if you read the book or see the movie, you see first he's a young soldier, and then he's a middle-aged guy, and then he's an older guy, he's a grand. And the movie goes back and forth in time. He's unstuck in time. And what I realize now that I didn't at the time, and I'm not sure Kurt Vonnegut really understood, is this was how he was dealing with the post-traumatic stress of having seen this awful bombing. And if you've known people who've experienced that or have had experience in war, other horrific things, it is very common part of stress to be brought right back to the moment of the stress. And that's what he was explaining. And though I've never experienced that kind of stress, it did seem to me that between Black Lives Matter and the civil rights movement of the 1960s and the Civil War of the 1860s, that I was getting kind of unstuck in time in terms of the fight for racial justice and equality. It seems to me in some ways that Black Lives Matter is trying to do the unfinished work of the civil rights movement, and that the civil rights movement was trying to do some of the unfinished work of the Civil War. And when I see the younger generation on the streets today, I both rejoice in their involvement and am saddened by their naivety sometimes, and also saddened by the knowledge of the evil that will befall them and all who support them. But it's work that has to be done. And I know the civil rights movement was trying to resolve those inequities of 100 years before. Because of the history of this congregation, I've gone back to try and better understand what that history meant. We were founded by abolitionists, most of whom had moved down here from the Boston area. They were very well-to-do, some of the richest families in America. In some ways, they could afford to be abolitionists. They founded this church. They lost a lot of money in the panic of 1857 and cut the salary of the minister. They helped to found and fund Abraham Lincoln's presidential run. They helped fund John C. Fremont's before, in 1856, when he got beat by James Buchanan. The center of the Republican Party was Staten Island. John C. Fremont lived on Staten Island when he ran for president. Now it seems to me that the Black Lives Matter movement, I've had a hard time sort of grasping it in some ways, and I think some of us who support it have shared that nebulousness. And I realize one of the reasons why is that Black Lives Matter now has to do the heavy lifting that in the 60s was done by the Southern Christian Leadership Conference led by Dr. King, also of SNCC, the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee that we remember Stokely Carmichael from, and the Black Panthers and Huey Newton and Eldridge Cleaver. Especially when white folks look at Black Lives Matter, they project all of these different things onto it. You know, and if they see the Southern Christian Leadership, they see these middle class black strivers, and they say, yes, we want to support that. If they see the Black Panthers, they see the berets and the open carry, and they recoil from it. And you know what? Black Lives Matter isn't any of those. It's its own thing, and we'll get into that a little bit more. And especially when Black Lives Matter get accused of being Black Panthers, I think they're way, way off the mark. Black Panthers dressed a lot more cool than Black Lives Matter. They also were advanced in the beginnings with with community programs, basically Head Start came out of what Black Panthers did in Oakland. They advocated open carry way before the people in Texas and North Carolina did. They advocated open carry so much it made Governor Ronald Reagan into a gun control advocate. So white folks in the media can project all kinds of stuff on Black Lives Matter. You know, some people think it's a justice organization. Some people have called it a terrorist group. People forget how hated Martin Luther King was in his day. What would be the reaction today if that number of black folks decided to walk across the Edmund Pettus Bridge today? They'd be met with more firepower than Bull Connor had. If black folks are increasingly understanding that their lives and their culture have been impacted by the decades and generation of the political realities that went before, I suggest that it might also be useful if police better understood their history. In the 1850s, there was one police force that was run in New York City, that was run out of Albany. They were controlled by the Whigs. They were Protestant and mostly Anglo. And they were designed mostly to keep the Irish immigrants in line. There was another police force run out of the mayor's office, actually run by Tammany Hall, and they were predominantly Irish Catholic. And we saw before is that at one point it was unclear which force was which. Eventually, the Tammany Hall, Democratic-controlled police force, became the New York City police force. So the New York Police Department, regardless of what it is or is not now, was born out of political corruption and racism. Now keep in mind, it's very easy to get unstuck in time. If you don't know your history, you're doomed to repeat it. Imagine what it was like to be a New York City police officer anytime after 1850. 1850 was when the Fugitive Slave Law was passed. So if you were a policeman in New York City and you saw a black person on the street, you had no way of knowing if that black person was a free person whom it was your duty to protect, or a fugitive slave to whom it was your duty to arrest and return to its owner. That was the position a policeman was in New York City in 1853, 1854, 1855. So fast forward today. What position do we put the police in today? Is that person carrying the history of his institutions as much as the black person is carrying the history of his or hers? We all carry the burden of history. And if we can't lay that burden down, we can't lay it down if we can't admit we're carrying it. One implication is it's not a bad apple here or there. It's a history and a system of unconscious oppression that must be rooted out. It's in the training of the police, how politicians use police, how individual officers are bound by stress, by unconscious attitude that pit us versus them, that make it an advantage to feel threatened. There is a Blue Lives Matter reality, as there is a Black Lives Matter reality. Blue, black, blue, black. All we do is end up being black and blue. But there appears to be an equivalency there that isn't quite accurate. Yes, both black and blue live very dangerous lives in this society. But from only one is it possible to retire with a pension. It's not a complete equivalency. I had an experience a couple of weeks ago. I was on my way to Robin L's house, the choir practice. As is my wont, I got there early, so I walked around the neighborhood of Belmont Place a little bit. And I found a middle-aged woman approaching me, and she was speaking. Now, if a person speaks on the street these days, you don't know if they're talking into their cell phone, they're responding to the alien speaking to them through the fillings of their teeth, or they're talking to you. But finally, I said, oh, she was talking to me, yes. And she said, you got a phone? I need to make a phone call. I need to make a phone call. There's drug dealers in front of my house. They won't let me in. And she was speaking in a much louder voice than that. I saw there was an apartment house 50 yards away. And there were four black men in their 20s standing at the front of that door. They were not doing nothing that I could see. They were having a casual conversation. They looked like anybody else would look in the neighborhood. But the woman was very agitated. And she said, you need to make a phone. And I said, well, I'm not quite sure. You want to borrow my phone and make a phone call? She said, yes. So we went over and the other shit apart. She sat down. Just reporting this now. She made the 911 call. And while she was waiting to get hooked up to the local precinct, out of a paper bag, she took a tall boy of Coors Light and started drinking it in one hand while she was waiting for the police to come on the other. And when the dispatcher, whoever she talked to, she very quickly got very agitated and started screaming in the phone and saying things like, there's drug dealers at my door. They won't let me in my apartment. I'm tired of this. You got to get somebody over here right away. I'm tired of this, you know what, and I'm not going to stand for it anymore. And you better get somebody over here. I'm tired. And then she hung up and she gave me the phone back. And I went, oh, you're welcome. And she said something like, well, I guess I didn't do that too well, did I? And I said, it might have been more persuasive if you hadn't been screaming at her. And so I don't know what I experienced. I experienced four black men standing in front of a apartment building, and they could obviously hear what the woman was saying. And during the course of the phone call, two of them left and got into a car. They didn't leave or anything, but they were in the car. And then I went to choir practice because I'm not a fool. But I don't know what was going on. I had no idea what was going on. And I started thinking about, and I got a phone call about 10 minutes later from the precinct, you know, saying, I don't know, she was really upset, but, you know, I loaned her my phone. I don't really know anything about anything that she said. So I don't know if any law enforcement showed up or not. For all I know, she makes that call every night. You know, or for all I know, there were drug dealers and they were keeping her out of her apartment or something in between. I have no idea. But I do know that if law enforcement came there, I had many hopes for the people who arrived. I hope that the law enforcement knew the neighborhood. I hope that they had support and backup. I hope that the person was very cool, with lots of interpersonal skills and social awareness, and a strong person and a good listener and not racist, but a good shot. In other words, I was asking for the impossible. I was asking so much of history and reality on the burdens of whoever did or did not show up. So I said a little prayer for everybody. The lady, the four dudes at the door, the police who might or might not have arrived, and everybody else in the neighborhood. It's time, maybe past time, for us to develop some action items and programming to support Black Lives Matter. Though I think that just displaying the banner is a kind of action. Black Lives Matter means different things in different communities, and we can make it mean in Staten Island what we want it to mean for us. I have found that black churches and black leaders in Staten Island are thrilled that we have put up that banner, and they would like to know what we're doing next. But they're not going to tell us what to do next. It's also my impression from the small sample size of Staten Island I have, that liberals and progressives have a bit of a negative attitude or siege mentality about justice and equality work on Staten Island. I think they may be envious that every other borough seems to have a lot more liberals and progressives than Staten Island. But hey, compared to Selma or Birmingham, or even some of the communities in which Black Lives Matter have flourished around the country, we're doing pretty good. I thought it might be useful for us to focus on gentrification down around the Staten Island area. There's going to be a lot of change going on there, a lot of economic development, a lot of political stuff. And I know when gentrification begins, economic development begins, policing changes. The standards of policing change, neighborhoods changing, and that's an opportunity. Because one of the things I've also found, when you want to see economic development, but the problem with economic development, when it turns into pure gentrification, is that the people who see economic development see ghetto, and the people who live there see community. And the economic developers don't know how to get rid of the ghetto aspect, and they don't see the community. And the people who live there saying, yeah, we might not have the best of everything, but this is where we live. This is our community. And for that element of Staten Island, down there, I'm not just talking about African American. I'm talking about indigenous, you know, communities that have been around there for a long time of all sorts of ethnicities. So that might be a useful thing for us to get really engaged in. And from what little I know, it seems like there's different groups that are kind of engaged, Staten Island be involved in all these little communities, to me it seems like it's a plus or a minus. You know, if you live on Tottenville or you live here, you live there, it puts things into a nice community local thing, but it also atomizes the community. There doesn't seem to be enough connective tissue between these different little areas to really get a unified Staten Island voice, it seems to me. But then I thought, in terms of gentrification, well, I think that's a good idea, but it's not for me to decide that. You know, I'll be gone in a while, and you guys will be left with whatever happens either to those four drug dealers on Belmont Place or the Ferris wheel or this church. You have to decide. So that's what we're going to do next year. Next Sunday, we want to decide and get moving on some very specifics. Now, I happened to come across on Facebook yesterday, or a couple of days ago, a really interesting aspect of Black Lives Matter. And it is that a professor at NYU named Frank Leon Roberts, actually right now has begun the first college level course on Black Lives Matter. It's a whole syllabus. And on YouTube is it's a 16-minute segment on YouTube, but his speaking is only about 10 or 12 minutes. And I put a little notation at the end of the order of service, so you can go back and take a look at that. And I really recommend that you do, because one of the things I've been looking for, because I'm a Unitarian, is an intellectual and historical framework in which Black Lives Matter exists. So it's not some sort of like YouTube, Instagram, Occupy thing. That it has some roots. And I'm going to sum up what Dr. Roberts says about Black Lives Matter, and you can go listen to him, and he'll be a lot more eloquent than I. He says, Black Lives Matter is a human rights movement, not a civil rights movement. A civil rights movement, like in the 60s, was trying to do things like voter registration and voter rights and pass laws and so forth. And they did, and they were successful to a certain extent in that. They were a human rights movement. But right at that same time, once Malcolm X got away from Elijah Muhammad, he became more of a guy about human rights. It wasn't just legislation. It was about, as Dr. Roberts said, who gets to count as human? Who gets to count as human? He says it's not only a human rights movement, but an intersectional movement. Is founded by three women, two of which were gay. Black Lives Matter is not just a black movement, it's also an LGBT movement, a feminist movement. It understands that all oppression is connected. Now that is really different from the civil rights movement and the anti-war movement in Vietnam, which was still, it's like women got annoyed because they made the coffee. And it was sort of a reaction about that that gave rise to real second wave feminism. Well, now you move forward to Black Lives Matter. The women just ain't making the coffee. The women are organizing and creating the organization. And so it's he uses the word intersectional for that way. He also said he used this word specifically, an abolitionist movement. He called it an abolitionist movement. He said abolition, not just reform. Not just reform, but justice. And you can compare that to what the Whigs were trying to do in the 1850s as opposed to the abolitionists who became the Republicans. The Whigs were always trying to compromise, right? The Missouri Compromise, you get one state that's free, one state that's slave, and they tried to keep that together until, frankly, the banks went bankrupt because there was so much violence out west they couldn't build the railroads. And that's what caused the Panic of 1857, which in a sense led to the Civil War. The Whigs tried to compromise with slavery, and they died. And so this is an abolitionist movement, not just a reform movement. He also said Black Lives Matter is an artistic movement, that it takes a tremendous amount of organization and performance to put on a protest these days. You know, I guess it has the right angles for everybody's cell phone and so forth, and how it's going to be covered. Image is everything. But he said that art has always been part of liberation movements. And he mentioned Strange Fruit and Blues for Mr. Charlie and Beloved. And finally, he said, Black Lives Matter is a prayer. It's a prayer of affirmation and aspiration. But faith without good works is dead. So let us go forth and pray our way to justice by acting for justice. What's next? The hymn?
Closing hymn in your mm-hmm.